Looking to connect with the brightest minds in tech transfer and innovation? Then don't miss your chance to advertise right here on Autumn on the Air. With a highly engaged audience of academic, government, and industry professionals, your message will be heard by the very people shaping the future of research commercialization. Whether you're launching a new product, building brand awareness, or recruiting top talent, the Autumn Podcast is where your message belongs. Contact info@autumn.net today to learn more.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Welcome to Autumn on the Air. Today's episode is particularly important as we examine the intersection of federal policy, scientific funding, and America's position as a global leader in innovation. We welcome back to the podcast Kate Zernike, a Pulitzer Prize-winning national correspondent for the New York Times, who has been with the paper since 2000. Kate was a member of the team that shared the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for their coverage of Al-Qaeda before and after the 9/11 terror attacks. Kate is perhaps best known in the scientific community for her groundbreaking story in 1999 while at the Boston Globe about MIT's admission that it had discriminated against women on its faculty. This reporting later became the foundation for her acclaimed 2023 book, The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins, MIT, and the Fight for Women in Science, which was named one of the 25 best books of the year by the American Library Association and was a finalist for the Royal Society Science Book Prize. The daughter and granddaughter of scientists, her grandfather was Nobel Prize-winning physicist Fritz Zernike. Kate brings both personal understanding and journalistic rigor to covering science policy. She holds degrees from the University of Toronto and Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Today, we'll be discussing Kate's recent reporting on two critical articles. U.S. scientists warn that Trump's cuts will set off a brain drain, published on June 3rd, and the surprising scientists hit by Trump's DEI cuts, published on July 10th. Welcome back to the podcast, Kate.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Lisa.
Yeah, it's really great to have you on today. And I wanted to begin by discussing your June 3rd article, U.S. scientists warn that Trump's cuts will set off a brain drain. And in this piece, you talk about Dr. Artem Patapoudian, who came from war-torn Lebanon when he was 18 years old, went to the University of California, delivered dominoes at night, and did research, and his research focused on pressure and how that translated into nerve impulses. And he eventually won the Nobel Prize. And it's really an amazing story, and it's the quintessential American dream story. In addition to him, you also talked to scientists like Rudolf Pisa at Harvard and Richard Buganer at Johns Hopkins. What emotions did you hear in their voices as you talked to them?
You know, I would say, you know, obviously it's a great deal of worry and anxiety about funding being cut, but I also think there's a sadness, frankly, because they, as you say, this is sort of the American dream story. And this is an enterprise that has been built up over the last really 70 years, right? If you think about Vannevar Bush and how he imagined this, I don't know if it's a three-legged stool or whatever, but this ecosystem that was going to come up between the federal government, universities, and ultimately industry. And that's really his vision has come to fruition. And it's changed, you know, as your own organization can be testament to, it's really changed the structure of universities. It's given birth to the biotechnology industry. So I think people are very worried. And I think what they're worried about is that the general public maybe doesn't understand how the system has been built up. As one person said to me, a researcher at Harvard, you know, the public sees us as parasites. They see us as, well, you're getting all this money from the federal government. You just keep taking. People don't understand what's being given back. And I think that's sort of the reason for the sadness. But there's also a sense of, you know, as I said, there's a sense of deep worry and, you know, real anxiety about the future.
Yeah. And you're talking about scientists who specifically came to this country because of its scientific freedom. And now it's essentially being taken away in a sense.
Right. That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, as one person said to me, you know, if you think about it, and I said this in the article, I didn't quote this person saying this exact point, but if you think about it, before World War II, the universities that American scientists wanted to go study at, if you were a serious American scientist, you went to Germany to study, right? And so we have not seen that since the Nazi regime came to power and ultimately fell in the end of World War II. But since the end of World War II, the focus has shifted to the United States. So it's not that American scientists are going, I mean, sometimes they do, but they don't have to seek out that expertise, that training in Europe. In fact, the rest of the world has come to us. We have been recognized as this leader.
Now, in your reporting, you also talk about how Johns Hopkins Neuroscience Department is 30% grad students and postdocs who come from overseas. They're international students. And Dr. Hugenayer describes losing them as losing 30% of our workforce. So I think this is another point that people don't understand that maybe you can clear up for us is why has American science become so dependent on international talent? And what are the long-term consequences if this pipeline is disrupted?
Yeah. Well, first, I should step back and say that the whole the basis for this story actually started out with an editor saying to me, you know, Trump had said he was going to go, you know, restrict Harvard's ability to enroll international students. And an editor said to me, oh, we should do a story about the effect of this on science. And I said, well, actually, it's really, and Dr. Padapudian said the same thing. It's not just international students. It's everything. But the international students are critical because, you know, as I said, the rest of the world has come to us for the last, you know, I don't say 50 years or so, because we built up this deliberate system. Now, why is that? I think people will give you a lot of different reasons. One is that this country no longer really prioritizes science or science education. You know, there's one statistic that only 30% of Americans can even name a scientist they know. And when they name a scientist, it's Einstein, right? Who's, of course, been dead for a long time. So I think there's a lack of familiarity and appreciation. I think we take a lot of science, even as we are on our smartphones, which are, of course, produced by this federal funding out of universities. And this cooperation between universities, industry, and the federal government, we take that for granted. Other countries, meanwhile, as someone said to me, you know, if you look particularly at India, she was saying, you know, the students there who take the test to get into top universities or top high schools, whatever it is, when they choose the top schools, they are choosing to go into science, right? Because they know that science is the most valuable career path. We have not really recognized that here. And so I think other countries, it's both that the United States has built up this incredible system that other countries want to come to, but it's also that other countries have more of a culture of appreciation around science, scientific innovation, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen something similar to what you're talking about in other countries as well. There's a real value placed on science and technology. And I completely agree with you on that point. And I want to go back to Dr. Padapudian for a second, because he called the current challenges a gift to China. That's something that you wrote in your article. What evidence did you find of other countries starting to actively recruit American trained scientists?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned China, because I think that is the biggest concern for people. Because China, of course, as the United States is pulling back on funding, China is investing more, both in biotech industry in particular, but also in universities. But we've also seen you do have Chinese universities that are trying to recruit American scientists, but you've also seen institutions in Germany and France in particular. You know, France has this, I forget what it's called, it's something, have a name for it. A Home for Science, I believe, is the name. So France has put that program out. I talked to someone in Portugal who said, I'm not sure Portugal's doing anything in particular, but they have, you know, she said that it was like, I think the interest was like fourfold since this whole thing started. So definitely something going on in France. You've seen German universities as well. But really China is the big one. The issue with China is not only sort of the threat of competition, but it's also what happens to that intellectual property once it's developed in China, right? So sometimes people will say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, right? Because science is a world without borders. And so the great discoveries will be made in Europe. So what's the problem, right? Or made in China. The problem is, how are we going to know that that intellectual property is coming out of China? And I think people obviously point to the COVID pandemic and our relationship with China over that. And what, you know, the information that we were getting and we're not getting out of China as kind of the cautionary tale.
Now, another really interesting point you made in your article is how America benefited from the rocket scientists who came here after World War II and helped us get to the moon. So for our listeners who may not grasp the stakes, can you explain how scientific talent migration has historically shaped global power dynamics and what this country stands to lose if this trend continues?
Yeah, that idea about the rocket scientists coming here was actually a point made by Marcia McNutt, who's the president of the National Academy of Sciences. And I think, you know, I think it's a couple of things. One is that obviously just the talent came here, so the discoveries were made here, right? And in particular, this country welcomed a lot of scientists, not just rocket scientists, but scientists in general, including some I talked to in that article, who came here fleeing fascism, fleeing the Nazis in particular. So there was just sort of the actual work that was done. But then there is also, again, there's a slightly more intangible notion of what this did to American supremacy in science, right? And America's reputation as a scientific powerhouse. So again, it's not just about what innovation is going to happen here, but it is about what is our reputation in this area and how does that reputation suffer? This is something that is built up over a long time, and you can't just sort of, you know, the uncertainty here is really the issue. What you keep hearing from scientists is like, we can't start and stop our funding, right? So maybe it's, you know, you could just say, well, I'm on hold hiring postdocs, but at a certain point, you're not going to be able to get the work done, and the work is going to go on hold, and work is already on hold. I should be clear about that. But it's not as though you could just sort of flip a light switch and everything goes back on again.
No, it's just not the way research works. And, you know, you mentioned Dr. McNutt. She also mentioned in your article that we're now embarking on a major experiment in restructuring the innovation engine in America. And I completely agree with that statement. And I'm curious, what kinds of research and breakthrough discoveries do you think are most at risk?
Well, I think the second part of her quotation was really maybe the most important, which is that, you know, I think she said China is not cutting its budget by 40%. And that specifically refers to the NIH, although, of course, the NSF is also facing big cuts. You know, I think my sense is that it's largely a biotechnology and computer science issue, because those have been the big fields, from my understanding, in this country where we really have seen this huge development of innovation coming out of universities through this relationship with the federal government and into industry. So that's my sense, but that may be colored a bit by that being sort of the area that I know best. But that would be my sense.
Now, how would you explain to policymakers the connection between federal research funding and America's technological competitiveness?
Well, I mean, I think obviously the comparison with China is the biggest one. You know, what's going to happen if China becomes this powerhouse? So I think there should be more understanding of how the system works, because I think that the person I mentioned, the scientist at Harvard, who said to me, you know, people see us as parasites. I think that's really the case. I do think there are people in government, you see some pushback, particularly on cutting the NIH budget. And I do think there are people in government who really do understand this, you know, who is, as Arlen Specter, Senator Arlen Specter once said, you know, the NIH is the crown jewel in the federal government. But I also think, you know, the Trump administration, Michael Kratsios has referenced Vannevar Bush and the whole idea of this enterprise. So I think there is some understanding of that, but I think even talking about the history of that and making people see that this is not just a gift to universities, right? This is actually something that universities are returning the investment, right? Like, I don't think most people know that most drugs come out of NIH research. There's this huge return on investment from NIH funding. Yeah. So I think in some ways it's sort of education. You know, I talked to someone when I was doing a story earlier about the cuts to mRNA research, and the threats to that, because which is, of course, coming out of COVID and the anger over COVID. And she was saying, you know, I don't like to tell people what I do. She's a scientist. And she had run into another man at a dinner party and she had said, what do you do? And he didn't want to tell her. And finally, she got out of him that he was a scientist. And so she said, isn't it interesting? Like, we don't want to tell people we're scientists. So then she was talking to someone else and that person said, when someone asks you what you do, the appropriate response is, I work for you, right? And I think that is something, that is where scientists have not made a great case. If you look at public trust in science, it has declined, but it's not in the basement. It's really sort of like, 30% of Americans who are really uncertain about it, but there's a good percentage of Americans who do still have trust in science. Where it gets a little squishy is Americans will tell pollsters that they don't think scientists are very good about communicating what they do. So I think that's actually, right now it's a hole, but that hole could also be an opportunity.
I agree with you. I think that's a great opportunity for scientists that they need to communicate better. And I love the line, I work for you, when being asked what we do, because I think it is so true. So very, very true. So, Kate, I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about your July 10th article, The Surprising Scientists Hit by Trump's DEI Cuts. And in that article, you reveal the paradox that many scientists losing diversity grants are actually from rural conservative areas, the very communities that supported the president. And it's challenging assumptions about who benefits from these programs. And you've profiled a couple scientists like Lucas Dillard from rural North Carolina and Billy Reniker from rural Georgia, both of whom are white researchers from Trump-supporting areas that lost diversity grants. So how do these programs define diversity beyond race and gender? And why was this broader definition important for American scientific competitiveness?
You know, it's fascinating when you look at some of these grant proposals that had generally what happens is there's a grant opportunity for a certain category, say early researchers or something like that. And then there is there's a portion of that grant set aside for diversity candidates. But what's fascinating is if you look at some of those grant opportunities and the way they describe diversity, race and gender is almost not mentioned, or if it is mentioned, it's way at the bottom. So what, and this is particularly the NIH, but not just the NIH, because the NSF does this as well, at least in some programs that I've seen. They're looking for people from rural areas where there is a underrepresentation of scientists or medical professionals. They're looking for people whose parents didn't go to college. They're looking for people who got Pell Grants, which indicates, a certain level of poverty. So it's really trying to make it more socioeconomically diverse. But it's also, the whole question, I think people increasingly question the value of diversity efforts. And the people who push back on that would say that there is a ton of research showing that the more ideas, the more input you have, the more different perspectives you have, that helps the question, right? Like, as someone, you and I have talked about women in science before, and as someone said to me about women in science, we rely on science to address our biggest challenges. Why would you want to even risk shutting out the ideas of half the population? I want more information, more ideas, not less. But also, there's really a question about how, as we think about developing the scientific workforce, there's really a question about who ends up in labs, right? And this is one of the reasons that, we are relying, as you asked me earlier, we are relying so much on international talent. So if you look at scientific labs, they tend to be populated. It's really fascinating and a little bit, I was shocked by this. They tend to be populated by people from higher socioeconomic groups whose parents have a higher level of education. And that stat in the story, I forget what it was, but it was something, I believe it's that university professors are 25 times as likely as the general population to have a parent with a PhD. So, you know, and that is, and so again, it's another one of these cycles, right? So it's, so those people are in science and then their kids are interested in science. So the kids can say, hey, dad, can you help me get an internship at some lab? And so I was hearing from these professors that they're getting calls from high school students saying, can I work in your lab? And it's, you know, there's no knock on that ambition. That's fantastic. But they do say, like, it tends to be someone like a friend of a friend or, you know, a colleague. And again, not knocking the ambition. That's great. But there's a whole sector of kids out there who don't even see this opportunity. They don't know what, I mean, I cannot tell you, almost every person to a one I interviewed for that story said to me, I didn't know what a scientist was growing up. And the other thing they said was, this was the rural people in particular, was that if you grow up in an area like that and you're interested in science, you know, one of Lucas Dillard won this, you know, sent me this adorable picture. I think he was 6 years old or sixth grade. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, he won this science fair. And so people knew he was good at science, but what they said to him was, oh, you can be a doctor, right? So it just happened to be that he went swimming in a polluted river near him and he got some sort of infection and he goes to see this doctor and the doctor says to him, you know, he says, I want to be a doctor. He talks to him about the doctor's path. And the doctor says, I think he said, you shouldn't go into pre-med. You should study biochemistry, right? That was because then your options are broader. And Lucas had no idea that the career that he has now even existed. So again, like, there's this very limited understanding. And so what these grants can do, these diversity grants can do, it's not about saying, oh, we want to show in some token way that there are more Black people or women in the labs. It's really like, let's open up opportunity to people who don't even see it.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's some really heartbreaking stories that you report on in your article as well, like Gabrielle Merchant, who grew up in foster care, and she lost her $3.5 million grant to study hearing loss. And you talk to other researchers like Ashley Albright and Nicole Gross, and tell us a little bit about how they describe the emotional impact of having their life's work suddenly deemed non-scientific or antithetical to scientific inquiry.
Yeah, so this was a very strongly worded email that they got canceling their grants. And the email suggested that the reason that they were doing research into DEI, well, they are not doing research into DEI. They're doing research into, in Gabrielle Merchant's case, hearing loss and ear infections and how they can cause hearing loss. So to be told that your research is not valuable in a letter that clearly doesn't even understand what your research is, it's very clearly a form letter. First, it was just incredibly galling, right? But again, in the end, it's just you go right to fear, anxiety, and sadness and worry about your career. And so one thing that I think, you know, we have to think about is again, the cycle effect. Like when people know, when you know, someone coming out of university can look and see that postdocs aren't getting jobs, PhDs are struggling to get jobs, everybody's looking to Europe or to China to think like maybe my opportunity is there. Someone who's coming out and studying science, they're going to say, well, maybe I shouldn't follow a scientific career. So again, it becomes a workforce issue for the United States.
Absolutely. And going back to Lucas Dillard, I know he and several of the scientists you interviewed described feeling betrayed by their home community's support for policies that ultimately ended up hurting them. You know, how do you think this disconnect happened? And what do you think it means for science communication in rural America?
Well, I think there really is a problem with science communication, that people don't understand this work. They're maybe afraid of it. Even as I said, you know, all you have to do is pick up your phone and see the value of science. So I think there has been not enough communication, too much taking for granted scientific research and the value of it. And so, you know, I do think there's an opportunity there. The problem, and I really think that this is a problem coming out of COVID, is that people are really shut down, because when you talk to them about science right now, what they think is vaccines. And everyone talks about the vaccines and what an amazing effort that was. And it was an amazing effort. But all people think of is vaccine mandates, lockdown. My kid couldn't go to school. I couldn't go to school. I couldn't work. Maybe you lost your job. I mean, it was really so that to me is the big hurdle. What are we going to do about this residual anger and fear and really resentment coming out of COVID and how it has been trained on science? Because look, if you look at the first Trump administration, it was not exactly friendly to science either, but the attacks on science and the stripping of the funding and the, you know, marching in and saying, we are going to have, you know, administration members sit in on grant proposal review. Well, we look at grant proposals. We're not going to have peer review anymore, or we're going to have peer review will be strictly advisory. That is coming out. That's a much more aggressive effort. So I think if you want to win trust back for science, one of the things you need to do is just talk about what science is.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the thing I got out of your two articles was that there are multiple simultaneous threats to American science. The funding cuts that we're talking about, the talent exodus, the diversity program eliminations, and now we all know that there are some IP threats based on, you know, potential marching in by the government to, let's say, take Harvard's IP. How do you think all these different elements compound each other, and what's the cumulative effect for America's scientific leadership?
Well, I think that it's obviously the uncertainty is destabilizing for people. As I said, I think, you know, young scientists going in who might be considering a career might rethink that. It's obviously a problem with, you know, innovation that's going to come out. I mean, we see well-established researchers who are having their grants stripped. So I think the uncertainty is really the problem, but it also becomes a workforce question, right? Because if you're not, you know, if you don't have investors in technology coming out of university labs, if you don't have people who want to take a bet on that, you're not creating jobs. So it's really, again, it is this relationship between the federal government, universities, and industry. I don't think anybody thinks that there wasn't room for improvement. You know, as one person said to me, like, I could spend all day long criticizing the NIH, but at the end of the day, it's the greatest invention in the world, and no other country does this, right? So we've seen the results of this in terms of economic development. And, you know, you just look at some of the lists of things that have come out of this arrangement, this cooperative arrangement. So I think it's just the sense is that we have to bypass American federal support, right? So, you know, we're looking to do agreements with other countries. So it's almost like we can't count on the United States. And I think for anything economically, like, you know, for economic stability, you need a stability of expectations. The uncertainty is really the problem.
Yeah, uncertainty is a huge problem. And you've documented really well in your article how countries are capitalizing on our own self-inflicted wounds. So from all this reporting and research that you've done, what would you tell a senator who asks, why should taxpayers fund university research when we have budget constraints?
Well, I mean, it's always a tension. And I'm not an advocate, so I certainly wouldn't, you know, tell people what to do. But I do think, you know, you have to look at the innovation that has come out of these labs and think about the return on investment that you've already seen. I think, you know, if you look at what the Trump administration is saying, they feel like, you know, there is concern about, you know, one of the things that they've talked about is this concern that there is not enough new innovation, right? So that the, you know, works being cited in papers, there isn't as much innovation being cited in papers and you don't have as much coming out of it. Well, maybe that is not a funding question. Maybe that's a question of, you know, should we be looking to fund more experimental things? But I don't think the solution is to cut off everything. So I think it just needs to be a much more open discussion about the value of this and what we've invested so far, what our return on investment has been. If you look at that letter that the administration sent to Harvard, the assumption was sort of like, well, prove to us that this money has actually churned out patents, like prove to us that this matters. And that's a pretty, I mean, you know, for Harvard to have to account for every patent, it's going to be huge,
yeah.
Because right. There's so many, what is it, 58,000 or something like that. But I do think, you know, people might need to make the case a little better about what's coming out of these labs.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to ask you again, I know you're not an advocate, but if you could sit down with Congress during the 2026 budget appropriations process, what would be your key messages about the importance of sustained federal investment in research?
Well, I think the critical word there is probably sustained, because it really, again, it is the uncertainty. So you have prominent researchers who are facing some federal cuts, but maybe they still get a lot of philanthropic money. And so they'll be okay, but they're not hiring postdocs. So they're on hold. So I think, again, like, you need to think about, if you want to talk about reforming the system, I think that's fine. But I don't think just cutting off the funding is perhaps the answer.
Now, are there some stories from your reporting that you think best illustrate what's at stake here?
Oh, I guess I would say, you know, in particular, I heard a lot of alarm about, this is just one story that sticks with me, I guess. But, you know, there's been great promise with mRNA technologies in prostate cancer. And then I, you know, was talking to another one of these young diversity researchers who was doing prostate cancer. And that work, her work is going to shut down. The mRNA work is on hold. And prostate cancer, I mean, first of all, I think cancer is very scary to people, with good reason. But prostate cancer is a case where if you catch it early enough, your survival rate is so much higher. And the survival rate is very low. So I think, you know, I think it's things like that. And I perhaps that's why I, and maybe a lot of reporters, keep going back to the, you know, a lot of the stories we've been telling are about these risks to health and bio research. And I think it is because that is perhaps most gripping to all of us, because we can all sense our own frailty and how we would feel in this situation. You know, if you were a family who had a child with one of these diseases and the trial was being shut down, you'd be devastated, beyond devastated. Yeah, angry.
So, Kate, as someone who's covered both the promise of American science through your work on women in STEM and now these current challenges, what gives you hope?
I think we have seen some pushback from members of the president's own party on funding the NIH in particular. So I think that we are seeing people make a strong case for American science. And I guess I also, you know, what I'm always hopeful about, whether it was, I think we probably talked about this when we talked about my book, you know, the best part for me in interviewing scientists is always asking them about their work, or saying, like, how did you get into science? What do you do? And there is such joy in their sense of discovery, their sense of, you know, this path they're on to understand new things, and how exciting it is and how promising it is, and how they really do want to give back to society. I mean, so I think that gives me hope, because I don't think that excitement has gone away, or that joy. Otherwise, we would see people just walking away. And certainly some people are walking away, but you also see people who are persisting, who are finding a way to make it work. So I would say that maybe that also is something to convey, you know, that this is work that people really care about. They feel very invested in it. They see the promise in this. So maybe we should start listening more to what the promise of that work is.
That's a great answer. Thank you, Kate. And thank you so much for all your reporting and hard work on university research. I know our listeners really appreciate all that you do. And thanks for spending time with us today.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate, for this crucial reporting and for joining us today. Listeners can find Kate's articles at newyorktimes.com and should read her book, The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins, MIT, and the Fight for Women in Science, to understand how determined individuals can create systematic change in American research institutions. The stakes couldn't be higher for American science and innovation. As Kate's reporting makes clear, we are at a crossroads where policy decisions made today will determine whether America remains the global leader in research and discovery, or whether we cede that leadership to other nations eager to welcome our best minds and our most promising innovations. To our listeners in Congress and the policy community, The 2026 budget appropriation cycle represents a critical moment to choose America's scientific future. The researchers, innovators, and discoveries at risk are not abstract concepts. They are the foundation of our national security, economic prosperity, and global standing. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.